There's two ways to approach your career, to approach your life. You can do what everyone else is doing and do it better, or you can do what nobody else is doing and don't have to invite comparison.
Welcome to the next episode of What's Next with Eric Wood. Our next guest earned his fame in the city of Cincinnati and is one of the most outspoken restaurant owners in the entire country, and that's my good friend, Jeff Ruby. Jeff is an Ivy League graduate from Cornell University and is one of the hardest working people I know. His journey from overcoming a rough childhood to building a restaurant empire is synonymous with the American dream. Today on the show, Jeff and I get into several different topics, including his journey in business, his multiple near-death experiences, the current state of the restaurant business in the times of COVID-19, and much more. I have known Jeff for many years, and I know you will really enjoy our conversation spanning topics from business, family, to faith, and more. A recent review came in from Gary Celine, and I'll read it. He says, "I love these podcasts. The thing I like the most is that football is secondary. Obviously, most of the guests are in football, but love the conversations that are about the person, not the player." Really appreciate that feedback, Gary, and I really appreciate everyone who has left comments. I try to read all of them, and I just truly appreciate the feedback, good or bad. I want to learn from this. I want to grow in this, and I truly appreciate that. And finally, remember to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. It really does go a long way in helping us produce content for you. Now, enjoy the show. Jeff, welcome to the show. Can't thank you enough for your time.
I appreciate it, Eric. Good to see you again.
Yeah, likewise. It's fun having the man who built the empire, the Jeff Ruby restaurants, my favorite restaurants in the entire world. It's awesome to A, call you a friend, B, get to spend some time with you this morning. And let's start off talking about you and start off telling the listeners about where you grew up and tell them about the athlete that you grew up being as well.
Well, I was born but never raised in New Jersey because I raised myself. I ran away from home when I was 15, so I didn't have your typical childhood. My mother was married four times. I call those guys my forefathers. And then my senior year of high school, I found out that my first father wasn't my biological father. It was somebody she wasn't married to, my senior year. So I ran away at 15, my sophomore year of high school, and lived in an 8x10 room in a rooming house for elderly people down in Ocean Grove, New Jersey, which is next to Asbury Park. Actually, I lived in Asbury Park, too. I lived in Neptune, New Jersey when I ran away. I graduated from Neptune High School. But, and there, you know, we had a bathroom that everybody shared down the hallway. I didn't have my own bathroom. But it made me who I am. My football coach turned my life around. And I never had anyone I wanted to make proud. And when a teenager or a kid doesn't have anyone he wants or she wants to make proud, that's a recipe for disaster. That's not good. But I never had anyone I wanted to make proud. And I was a loser in love in every minute of it until Jeep Bednarik, my football coach, took me under his wing, and that changed my life. So I went from my freshman year of football, I was the last kid on the team to get the jersey. There was two kids fighting for the last jersey, and they just put us in a ring with the rest of the players around us until one guy was left standing, and he got the best jersey. And in my biography, Not Counting Tomorrow, one of my best friends in high school told my co-writer, he said, he remembered it. I didn't even remember. He said, Jeff didn't care if he made the football team or not. He just wanted to whip the guy and get the last jersey because he didn't want to lose. And it's true, I didn't care. I didn't play my freshman year at all. And then my senior year, I'm first team All-State and captain of a undefeated football team. And I went out for wrestling my sophomore year. I didn't win a match. My senior year, I didn't lose a match.
Wow. But
that influence on me was my football coach, and who took an interest in me. And and that changed me. And then I went to Cornell and played football there. So I was a decent athlete. Actually, I was first team all state in football. And you know, so I'm in my high school sports hall of fame. So, you know, I was a decent athlete.
That is an absolutely incredible story. It's an incredible testament to all the high school coaches out there. And I know my high school coaches had a tremendous impact on me. One of my great friends, Kyle Williams, who played for the Bills for 13 years, could do a number of different things, been offered network TV jobs and all that. He turned all that down to be a high school coach. And he said, look, my daughter is in ninth grade now. I'm going to influence the guys that she spends time around. I'm going to influence a community down here. And I just think that's tremendous. And you're an absolute testament to it. And I love what you talk about hope and trying to impress somebody. I mean, that man, those words are so powerful. And I've honestly never heard it put that way. And it's incredible to hear that. And you go from a guy who runs away from home at 15 to a Cornell grad. I mean, that is just absolutely incredible.
I had an F average my freshman year of high school. F average. I was kicked out of algebra because I had a 50 average, and they put me in basic arithmetic. So I went, you know, academically, I was horrible until I turned my life around. Yeah, my freshman year, I was failing everything.
Was it more dedicating yourself, hard work? Was that because you obviously have the smarts if you get to a Cornell degree, you have some type of intelligence. Is it just the work ethic that was lacking at that time?
Well, it was my attitude. I didn't, you know, I kind of, my entire childhood, I was different. You know, I didn't really have any siblings. It turns out my brother, who was 6 years older than me, he went with his father. When I was born with blue eyes, that's when my father realized he wasn't my real dad. And that's when he got out and left. And he took his son, who was his real son. And so we had the same mother. So when I got older and learned all this stuff, my childhood, I didn't care about anything. You know, I was working in the restaurants since I'm 12 years old in my mother's kitchens and restaurants. I fired my first chef when I was 13 years old, you know?
Wow.
And in seventh grade, we had a phone booth in the hallway. And I raised my hand and asked the teacher if I could go to the bathroom. And she said, yeah. Well, I didn't go to the bathroom. I went to the phone booth. And I called my mother's restaurant, the Grapevine. And Connie, the waitress, said, yeah, Jeff. I said, how's it going? And she said, not good. The chef didn't show up. We have no chef. And I said, where's my mother? She's homesick. And she said, I don't know how we're going to get ready for lunch. We don't have anyone here to cook to get ready. We open for lunch. And I never went back into the class. I left the phone booth and went 5 miles and change running down to the restaurant. And the school was in basically in Ocean Grove, New Jersey. And so I ran, and it was all on Main Street. My mother's restaurant was in Allenhurst, New Jersey, on Main Street. So I had to go through Ocean Grove. I had to go through Asbury Park. And I had to go over the lake, Deal Lake, and Lock Arbor. And then I wound up in Allenhurst in my mother's restaurant. And I got in there, and I started cooking and trying to get a cookbook out to figure out how to make soup for the lunch crowd. And then this guy walks in the kitchen. I said, who are you? He says, I'm the new chef. The employment department sent me out here. I said, oh. So my mother called the employment agency or whatever, the state, Monmouth County. And they said, we need a chef at the Grapevine. And well, we got somebody. So he shows up. So I had started a split pea soup in the back kitchen. The kitchen was just tiny. And everything was back there where you cook the food, the prep it, the dishwasher, everything. And I got a cookbook off the shelf, started making a split pea soup. In the dining room was the main kitchen where the food came out of the kitchen to serve the people and get the servers, the waitresses, for food. So I went up to the front and started slicing tomatoes and and ripping the membrane off of skirt steaks for London broil and doing all that. I come back and my soup had turned from the color of split pea soup to some chartreuse looking color. And I said to the chef, I thought I screwed up. I said, what happened to my soup? You know, I'm trying to learn here. What did I do wrong? He said, I put milk in it. I said, you put milk in it? He said, yeah. I said, the recipe didn't call for milk and split pea soup. He said, well, that's how I make my split pea soup. It looks horrible. I said, well, this isn't your split pea soup. This is my split pea soup. He said, well, I'm the chef here, and I've cooked the way I want it to be cooked. I said, well, you ain't the chef no more. You're fired. He said, what? I said, you're fired. And he said, who are you? I said, I'm the owner's son, and she put me in charge, and you're fired. So he left. So now I run down the street to a kind of a drugstore and grocery store, and I found me some green food coloring. I came back and poured some green food coloring in it to bring it back to some kind of green. So that was the first chef I ever fired when I was 12 or 13. I was in seventh grade, whatever that is.
That's hilarious. And I've known your son Dylan since his early 20s, and I'm trying to picture him, you know, 8-10 years younger, firing someone at a restaurant. Oh man, that's an incredible story. So that is how you got introduced to the restaurant business, you know, working in your mother's spot.
Yeah, and two of my stepfathers had dives, you know, and my one stepfather had famous hot dog places, Sid's, the best hot dogs anywhere. And he was famous, actually. And I'd work at the Grapevine in the summer and take my bike from Allenhurst, New Jersey to Bradley Beach, New Jersey to the ocean. Now, that's quite a bike ride. And then I'd wind up working nights at his place. And it was all they never paid me. You know, so I worked at those kind of restaurants.
Wow. Did you have any restaurants before you started the Jeff Ruby's high-end restaurants?
No, I worked, when I graduated Cornell, I worked for a company called Weingartner Hammers. They're out of Cincinnati headquarters. And I started working at Holiday Inns when I graduated college was in a junior assistant innkeeper. And I worked my, you know, way up to regional director. I focused on the restaurants and on the nightclubs there. And, but I did, the Precinct was my first restaurant in 1981. And that was only made possible, Johnny Bench and Pete Rose decided to back me. And when they decided to back me, they were two of the biggest names in sports back then. And they backed me. And then other guys that I didn't know got in the deal just to be on a restaurant with Johnny Bench and Pete Rose. They didn't know who I was. Johnny and Pete did, and that's why they backed me. And the Precinct became actually the first upscale steakhouse in Cincinnati and is the longest running fine dining restaurant in Cincinnati. And that was in 81. I mean, we're going on 40 years here now.
Right. And shoot, I'm 34 years old. It's been around since I've been born, and I grew up in Cincinnati. And I'm telling you, if you grow up in Cincinnati, there is nothing like the Jeff Ruby's brand. Jeff Ruby's epitomizes fine dining and hospitality, period. And now I live in Louisville, Kentucky, and the Jeff Ruby's in town here is the gold standard. What separates, in your opinion, Jeff Ruby's from the rest of high-end steakhouses, where you have a place that's been around for almost 40 years in Cincinnati, you know, been through a lot of ups and downs, you know, with financial times around the country, but the Precinct still stands?
There's two ways to approach your career, to approach your life. You can do what everyone else is doing and do it better, or you can do what nobody else is doing and don't have to invite comparison. And what I tried to do is be different. So I broke every rule in the book when I did the Precinct on how to do a steakhouse. I had a discotheque above the restaurant, which was crazy. I broke every rule. Steakhouses, we did a New York Steakhouse, Chicago Steakhouses. were a certain, like a men's club. And what I did at the precinct, and we've still been doing, is I want women to feel comfortable coming in. And so we did it. And by the way, those steakhouses only hired male waiters. I hired female and male, hired young people going to college, and I had the nightclub, and it was a C and B scene place. And every movie star, rock star, jock star, Sylvester Stallone, I mean, John McEnroe, name a sport, name a, you know, it didn't matter. They all came to the precinct, especially if they were flying in from out of town for a game or whatever, whether it was the Los Angeles Dodgers, the Oakland Raiders. So they wanted to hang out at that bar because that's where all the action was. And the restaurant downstairs only had 68 seats. So we needed that other revenue stream upstairs. But we did it different. And then I waited about 6-7 years in loading over there on barges and then expanded that. And we just did things differently. But the key to the whole thing is your employees. You'll never be successful unless your employees want you to be successful. I paid for their hospitalization from day one. And we really, really consider it a family affair with our employees. They're very close. The saddest day of my life was when we had to lay off 600 employees just a few months ago. It was a tearjerker for me. And, you know, I've had some pretty rough days in my life. I don't know if you saw my tweet about an hour ago, but I've had some rough times, but we all have. But that was the saddest day. So the employees are the key, making them a part of the success, because they're the most important asset you have.
Well, me and my wife got out last week for the first time on a date since all this COVID stuff happened. And naturally, we went down to Jeff Ruby's, just the two of us. And I can attest to you that your employees, they act like they wanted to be successful. They were so excited to be back in business and back working that you could tell that they work for someone. And that's a testament to you. That's a testament to the general managers you hire, the chefs and everybody, because they act like they want to be there. And so for the owner to talk about it and then the employees to act that out, man, there's just great chemistry there. I got a quick story about the precinct. My first time ever at a Jeff Ruby's restaurant, I'm down in Louisville. I just signed with my agent. It's after my senior year of college. And he said, okay, well, where do you want to go? And I said, if you got to go to Jeff Ruby's, I've never been before. I grew up in Cincinnati. I've never been. I got to go. And so that was my first time ever being at one. My agent took me, my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, my mom, my stepdad, we went over there. But I called you. We were going on a bachelor party a few years ago. A buddy of mine, Pete Nocta, who you know as well, who works in football at U of L, had cancer, and he's getting married. And we're going up, and we're going to go to Belterra and play golf and go to – well, it's going to pour down rain. So I said, scratch the plans. Let's go up to Cincinnati. Let's do Topgolf. I called you the day of. We got 20 people. I said, hey, Jeff, what do you think the chances are we can get 20 people into the precinct tonight? I said, you know, what's it for? I said, it's for Pete Nocta. You remember Pete? He said, oh my gosh, yes, I remember Pete. That top room at the precinct was the perfect spot for a 20-person bachelor party. You can smoke a cigar up there. It's got the ventilation. It is absolutely incredible. I want to thank you again for that. But that was my first time at the precinct. We go downstairs. It's an old police station. It's the coolest looking building and restaurant. Sits right on the outskirts of Cincinnati in a perfect location. But we go downstairs, the band's playing, and I get up and sing with the band. We had a phenomenal night, but I just want to thank you again for that. And yeah, you know, you said that laying off those 600 people was the toughest day in the restaurant business. Is this COVID-19 time, is this the biggest adversity that you've had to face in the restaurant business?
Oh yeah. It's been stressful for, you know, no matter what line of work you're in, but the restaurant business, is indoors. It's close. It's intimate. It's everything that you're not supposed to be doing right now, mm-hmm. And you can't eat food and drink a drink with a mask on. And then you put the mess on the employees and it takes the personality out of it. You don't even know if the employees being friendly or smiling at you. But July 13th of 87, I was in a car accident. And so what is that? 33
years ago.
33 years ago today, I was pronounced brain dead. And I was given a 5% chance of living. And, well, I overcame that. And but coming back to work, I was supposed to stay away from work for at least a year. And neurosurgeons and neurologists, everybody. I was back 2 weeks after I got out of the hospital. But I wasn't, my brain was healing. And it was, you know, I wasn't behaving too good. And I wasn't ready for it. But, you know, me, I just didn't. I had, and we had the waterfront, which was a monster. The waterfront, I mean, we'd have 1,500 people outside of, just on the outdoor bar on college night. Plus, wow. We had the nightclub upstairs. Plus, we had the restaurant, you know. And the place was huge. It was on three barges. So that was a difficult time for me. And back at that time, our corporate headquarters included me and a secretary. You know, now we got like 30-some people in our corporate office. Wow. It was just me. And so that I got through that. And I'll get through this. But this has been tougher for all the employees and for all the other people, you know, than it was back then. Although putting up with me if you were an employee back then wasn't easy. And I was losing it. My mind, you know, if I saw something I didn't like, I'd throw the plate of food against the wall. And I was a mess. But I had no business being there. I was not supposed to be at work. So,
well, you live and learn. And now I saw when the restaurants reopened and you stopped in, they gave you a standing ovation in the kitchen. So I know they're not worried about you throwing plates against the wall now. So we all grow up and we all learn.
That was over 125,000 views. And I didn't even know that was coming. And my daughter said, Dad, why don't you go in the kitchen? Say hello there. I said, okay. And yeah, that was something. I got tears. But the employees are, you know, we have, I don't call them customers, I call them guests. But the employees and our guests have made everything possible for me and have made me successful. And so you can't get your guests without your employees. And then a restaurant business with no guests is out of business. So those were the two reasons that we became successful. But always treated the employees well, always took care of them. They were family. See, when I grew up, I started hanging out at my mother's restaurants when I was 8 years old, and 9 years old, and 10 years old. I didn't play Pop Warner football. I wasn't in Little League. I just hung out at the restaurants. And from a very early age, those employees, the dishwashers, you know, I got to know them, and a lot of them were Hispanic, and I learned filthy Spanish in the kitchen from them, all the bad words. And I was just a little kid, but they were my family. And that evolved into how I treat the employees when I started managing at Holiday Inns and when I owned my own restaurant. I just, you know, it goes back to my upbringing of the restaurant employees being family to me more than my family was family to me, you know? And so that's where that attachment and that feeling of family came in starting at 8 years old.
You mentioned family, and you mentioned Brittany, your daughter, telling you to walk in the kitchen. Your son Dylan, who I know, works there, and then also your son Brandon works for everybody's under the Ruby umbrella now. You got seven restaurants, cover three states. What's the future of the Jeff Ruby's culinary brand?
Well, right now, I think every company's kind of in a holding pattern, unless you selling masks. Masks is big news today some company just sold 100 million masks.
Wow.
But we turned down Las Vegas a little over a year ago and a big new development. We turned down Indianapolis a couple years ago. I'm glad we did. And I'd hate to see where we'd be if we had to be running down to especially Las Vegas. It's so far to run the supply line from Cincinnati your corporate headquarters to Las Vegas, and it's expensive. Mm-hmm. So we try to keep everything lined up in terms of the geographical radius and the routing and how we can get to these places. And most restaurants, the main restaurants, the reason restaurants go out of business is absentee ownership. And we don't want that. We want to be visible. We want to check out these places. And it's hard enough in 3 states and 7 restaurants than if you had 50 places all over the country. You can't maintain the kind of quality you can by having your finger on it.
Yeah, and that's a great lesson in business right there, because when you think of Jeff Ruby's, I mean, that's the type of hospitality, that's the high-end hospitality you associate with Las Vegas. But if you go out there and you're never there, or you're out there too much and you neglect your ones here, and you can't be everywhere, then everything's going to suffer. And that's an incredible lesson in business. And you have you told your story about growing up, and I know that's why you have a passion for this younger generation, and you pour into so much youth, and you started your foundation and all of that to pour into the youth and give them positive role models. And you share a lot of your favorite advice on Twitter, which I love following. I feel like I'm older than the generation you're specifically gearing towards, and I get so much out of it myself. What's some of your favorite advice that you give to this younger generation?
Jeez, I got my next book ought to be my kid tips. People tell me there's so many of them, and I hope I can keep track of them. But I've given a lot of speeches at high schools and at colleges and football teams, but I tell them that, you know, figure out what you love doing so much that you would do it for free and make that your career. Number one, you will have never worked a day in your life because it's just so much fun. You don't even think of it as work. Number two, if you love something that much, you're going to have a lot of passion doing it. You can't be successful without passion. There's no way you could have played football and been good at it if you didn't have a passion for football, you know. And as hard a work as football was for you, and dangerous and everything else, you never worked a day in your life. You're doing something you love that you're good at, right? And you're talented at. Well, same thing with me, you know. So in the restaurant business, if you're going to be successful, if you really love something that much, and you know, I wanted to be an NFL player. That was my dream. And especially, you know, I did good in Jersey and high school, and we were a school with 1,800 kids, half black and half white and one Jew. I was the Jew. And I can relate to minorities, especially being Jewish, you know, but especially at that high school. And then when I went to Cornell, I said, man, I wanted to play, be a linebacker, and I blew out my knee in my freshman year against Princeton, at Princeton University, and I never played linebacker again. I wound up going to defensive tackle my senior year, and because I lost a lot of agility and getting back in my hook zones, and you know that back in those days there was no arthroscopic surgery. They just sliced it. My left knee looks like a softball. And the orthopedic for the New York Giants did the surgery. And but those days were over. I said, you know, so I wasn't going to be a football player. And I also wanted to be a rock star, you know, so, and singer. So what I did was at Cornell, I started my own band my sophomore year. And I had a band. I was the lead singer. We did a rock, we did a lot of R&B, and I made all my money going to Cornell, playing football, trying to keep my grades up, working in the restaurants here, and having my own band.
Wow.
But so I got to do that and get paid for it, but I never made it, you know, any further than that. Except I've sang on my stage with Garth Brooks in Nashville. I've sang with Toby Keith in 3 of my restaurants in 3 states. So I get to do a little bit of that. But so I wanted to be a rock star. That didn't work. I wanted to be a football player. That didn't work. And the rock star was a matter of talent. The football, plus, I was only 5'11". I wasn't really going to, 5'11", 205, and I was playing defensive tackle back then. So I wasn't going to make it in football. So what else did I love doing? Well, I grew up in this business. I loved it. And it was the only thing I really knew. And I have a hard enough time being successful in this business, and it's something I've been doing my whole life. I can't imagine doing something else that I don't know anything about.
Yeah, that's phenomenal advice. And I, too, have aspirations of being a rock star. And my buddies joke that I like to hold get-togethers at the house with live bands just so that I can get up and perform in front of everybody. And I don't know how much talent I have. I don't think a whole lot, but you could probably attest to this. If you know the words and you sing your heart out and you don't goof around, people respect that, because people get up there and they act goofy and you say, get them off stage. But if you own it, people respect that, because a lot of people don't have the guts to get up there and do it.
Well, you know how the thing started. My freshman year, and a stock house called DU, Delta Upsilon, just about all football players. So we'd go to these fraternity parties, and that's one of the reasons I started a band, because it was like 50 fraternities, and plus clubs around town. There's you can make some money. They need bands, right? So me and my freshman buddies would get up on stage. Not that there was a stage, it was on the floor of a basement of a fraternity, but we'd get up there and start singing, okay, with the band, grabbing the mics and doing all that stuff, being drunk. And the upperclassmen, they said, Jeff, you got a good voice. You ought to start your own band. Don't bring your buddies into the band. They're not good, but you're good. And I heard that enough, and so I started my own band. And my thrill was, back then, there was no better group, and they were in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, than Sly and the Family Stone. And they were huge. And they were playing at Hobart College. And an agent called me up and said, we want you to open up for Sly and the Family Stone. I almost hung up on him. I said, are you serious? You want my band? And there was a lot better bands than our band around there. There were groups that lived in town that weren't even Cornell bands, but they were, Wilmer and the Dukes, which was like a band like Otis Day and the Knights and the Animal House, that big R&B band and great. There were so many good groups. So we opened up for Sly and the Family Stone at Hobart College. And the trouble is, we had 50% of our repertoire was Sly and the Family Stone records, so we couldn't do those songs.
Right.
But it was I enjoyed it. I was a decent singer. And we did a lot of Young Rascals stuff back then. They'd later be called the Rascals. And they're in the Hall of Fame, too. And I had a drummer from Trumansburg High School, a teenager. And he was the drummer. And he sang, and he had the long hair and all that. He sang all the rock stuff. I sang all the R&B. I did all of the Motown, all the soul music, and all of that. And he was the other lead singer. We only had two lead singers. But he did all the Rascal stuff. And then I'm in Nashville, and I meet the founder and lead singer of the Rascals. And he's become a friend of mine. And you look back, Felix Cavalier of the Young Rascals. And I met him in Nashville when we were doing that. I met him at a restaurant while we were under construction. We'd become friends. And he comes over to my restaurant in Nashville. I said, come up on the stage. And the band knew all of his songs just because they're standards. I mean, those songs are classics, the Rascals. So he got on the keyboard and started playing and singing. And I'm singing with him, and I'm singing with the Rascals. I'm singing with Felix Cavalier. It's like, wow. You never think that's going to happen one day when you get older.
Yeah, that's incredible. If you can ever introduce me to Toby Keith and get me to sing with him one night, that would be an ultimate bucket list item for me. My go-to is Should Have Been a Cowboy by Toby Keith. That's, and I say my go-to, that's pretty much my only one I got that I can nail. So you let me know when we get that done.
I had met Toby Keith, backstage at a concert, but I didn't know him. So he's sitting in Jeff Ruby's in Cincinnati with his wife in the back of the restaurant. And I walk over, turn left after your hotel. I know this neighborhood all too well. I started singing, Who's That Man? And Who's That Man was a song that I would sing. I would make my band or my piano player learn that song, and I'd get up and sing it. My wife didn't like that at the time because we were married, and it's about a guy that's divorced and he's coming back. Who's that guy living in my house? And, you know, that's my dog in my backyard and all this and that. And I started singing it before he ever met him. He said, sit down. I like that. And we sat. And then later that night, we sang out on my, we went on the piano, had a cigar. And then we went inside and sang with the band. And then actually, he hooked me up and took me to the semifinals a couple of years ago when Alabama beat Oklahoma in Miami. So he got the tickets. I sat with his son, went on the team bus with Bob Stoops to the game. And everything. I got to know him pretty well. But then he sang with me in Nashville on stage. He sang with me in Louisville on stage. Boy, was he was feeling it pretty good then. He was getting carried away. So people are sitting at the bar and they're listening to Toby Keith. How do you beat that? You know, Derby weekend, you're sitting at a big horseshoe bar, and there's Toby Keith up there singing to you. And there's no cover charge, you know, for that. So that was fun.
That's really cool. So a lot of athletes, when they get done playing professional sports, they want to get into the restaurant industry. What advice or what warnings would you have for those people?
Well, Kenyon Martin called me about a year ago.
One of my favorite athletes of all time.
And he's getting ready to do some kind of sports thing somewhere in a couple of cities. And in fact, who was it? Another player that I knew called me, and then he set it up with a conference call with Kenyon. And I told him the same. And Corey Blunt, when he played at UC before he went to the Lakers, he was like a son to me, still is. And we're coming back from Memphis on a team plane, and he comes up and sits with me. He said, Jeff, when I get done with this, I want to own a restaurant. Tell me how to do that, you know. And eventually he did one. But I'll tell you what I told Kenya Martin was, you better get yourself a hell of a management company that knows how to professionally run a restaurant or a bar. You just can't put your name on something it's going to be successful because it's named after me, but the food's not good, the service isn't good. And you talked about the hospitality early. Service is more important than food because, you know, your employees can touch a guest. Food can't touch a guest like a person can touch a guest. And it's an emotional connection with our employees and our guests. So you can't, you know, Oprah Winfrey had a place in Chicago and it didn't work. Oprah Winfrey.
Right.
If there's anyone bigger in Chicago than Oprah Winfrey, maybe it's Michael Jordan. His place in Chicago didn't work out. Okay. So, and you can't, it's like a restaurant with an incredible view. If you have an incredible view, you could be looking over the skyline. You could be looking, whatever. If the service and the food and the ambiance other than the view isn't up to par, you know, you're not going to sit there and just look out the window. You got to eat. And it's the same thing with a star's name on it. You know, Toby Keith told me the whole story about his name. I mean, what that guy that stole from him, and I think it was Rascal Flatts, the guy was in the mob. The guy was in the mob, and all the Toby Keiths, except a few, were gone. And he told me about the guy, and then he told me about blah, blah, blah. So I text John Gotti Jr. I said, tell me, is this true, this guy? And then right in front of Toby, John Gotti Jr. texts me back, yeah, he's telling you the truth, blah, 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 about this gangster who has finally, I think, been arrested. Finally. Because he got away with it. But he was a mobster that somehow scammed the whole, and they did it with other big stars. So you got to be careful who you're in bed with, you know, no matter what your name is.
Yep, that's great advice. What is your favorite meal to order at one of your restaurants?
I like a strip steak, you know, or a ribeye. But, and I like the macaroni and cheese. So if I'm going to have a meal, you know, and I try to eat, you know, we have a lot of other, we have great fish and we have, you know, all kinds of, we have a, it's not steak it or leave it at our restaurants. We have terrific chefs, terrific culinary director, and incredible corporate pastry chef. The desserts are ridiculous. The ice creams are homemade, the desserts, the, the cakes. It's so, but I'll take probably a strip steak and a macaroni and cheese, and we got a potato Anna. It's incredible potato. It's the best I've ever tried anywhere. And, you know, maybe a Greek salad.
There you go. So I'm Freddy salad, a Jeff Ruby or Godfather roll, whatever they're calling it at the time, which is
I had that the other day.
Which is my favorite sushi roll. Sushi is my favorite food. It's my favorite sushi. You talk about lobster, asparagus, rice, so very simple. And then you got thinly sliced strip laid over the top of it, torched to cook it, put the sauce on it. It's absolutely incredible. So I'm going Freddy salad, Ruby roll. I'm doing the barrel cut filet. All the sides are good.
The Freddy salad is interesting. It started in about 1981 at the Precinct. It's a BLT salad. It's right. The first BLT salad ever. I mean, they're all over that, all over the world. You have a bacon, lettuce, tomato salad. But we had a regular that would come in, and he wanted just to take our romaine and whatever and throw some dressing on it and chop up some bacon and tomatoes. And his name was Freddie Mayers. And he was a big shot, still is. So when he came in, you could get hot slaw or Greek salad to come with your dinner when I opened the Precinct in 81. But he wanted this other salad. So restaurant employees have their own names for stuff that doesn't come on the menu. So, and it didn't have a name. So the waiter would just go in, I need a Freddy salad. So you know that Freddie Mayerson's in there, and we called it a Freddy salad. Well, later, it was so popular, and everybody liked it. We just put it on the menu, and we just called it the Freddy salad. That was years before anyone came up with a BLT salad. So as far as he's concerned, and where I'm concerned, he invented it. But we were the first restaurant, you know, to have it. And as far as what you're talking about sushi, about doing things different, when I had the Waterfront, which was a steakhouse on the river in Covington, Kentucky, and we had a raw bar. And I decided to take half that raw bar and introduce sushi. It was the first steakhouse in America with a sushi bar.
Wow.
Back in the mid-80s. I didn't think it would last, but it lasted. We never closed it down. And now we have sushi at, we have a sushi bar in Nashville. We have a sushi bar in Louisville. We have sushi at Jeff Ruby's, but there's no place for the actual physical sushi bar. And we have a sushi bar in Columbus, you know, Lexington. So we introduced sushi to a steakhouse, I think, before anybody. So we try to do something different. We try to just be different and keep adding things like an amusement park adds a new ride every so often to keep the package fresh, to keep innovating. And I keep remodeling so people don't see the same tired look all the time. They see something innovative, different, because they're digesting the ambiance, like you said, with every bite of food and every sip of wine. So that's what we try to do.
Well, I got dinner next Thursday at Jeff Ruby's, and I cannot wait to tell the story of Freddie Mayers when I ordered the Freddie salad off the menu. And so we go through recurring questions each week, and so we'll hit you with a few right now. Besides your own book, Not Counting Tomorrow, what's your favorite book?
Oh, I was going to tell you that was my favorite book.
Well, we're promoting that one, so you don't got to worry about that.
Put the besides in there. Because I have now written as many books as I've read. One, you know. But so I like The Art of War. I read that a long time ago. And it's a Bible, really, for – and I like the Bible, too, by the way. You know, I'm not – we have a faith-based company. My daughter she was Dean's List of Religious Studies at UC. And my son-in-law is ordained. You met Caleb Miller, the former Bengal. So, you know, and you know Elliot Walden, the owner of Windstar Farms?
Yeah.
In Louisville? Near Lexington. Every day he sends scripture from the Bible to a group of people. And I don't know who else is on that little group, chat, but so I get those verses every day. I got one already this morning and I read that. So, but The Art of War was good. And I just read a, speaking of Louisville, David Novak, former CEO of Yum Brands.
He's been a podcast guest.
And he sent me his book called Great One. It's laying right here on my table right now. And I just got another chapter to read and I'm done with that. It's a terrific business book, you know, so those are good books.
Yeah, David's phenomenal. I was actually texting with him this morning and he was a former podcast guest. And that's great about Elliot and what a great thing they got going with Windstar Farms. Holy smokes. And you just mentioned running a faith-based company, but what role does your faith play in your life?
Well, I told you about my near-death experience, and I've had a few of them. I was one of the last 10 people out of the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire on May 28, 1977. It was over here in Southgate, Kentucky, and I was fortunate to get out. I've been in a few near-death experiences. But the one in Cincinnati in 87, July of 87, when I came out of that hospital, and I was told 5,000 prayer lines were set up for me. 5,000 wow. prayer lines. And I wasn't supposed to live. And I, if I did, I wasn't supposed to come out of the coma. And so that's when I really realized that God has kept me around because he wants me to give back and every day trying to thank him. So by helping others. So I always used to do things for people. I was a pretty nice guy, generous. But when I came out of there, I realized how fortunate I am to be alive, you know, and that's where it really initially. And then my daughter is just, she's very, you know, she doesn't call it religious, she calls it relationship with God.
Absolutely. God's not done with you on this earth yet, Jeff. And I heard your daughter, Brittany, on Brian Tomey's podcast, who's the pastor of Crossroads Church in Cincinnati. And sure, she did a phenomenal job.
He was the first podcast I did. I did up at Crossroads. And my daughter's incredible. She's been on Today's Show over this COVID thing. She's been on Fox News with Bill Hemmer. She's been on CNN with Aaron Burnett. She's been on everything. She's been on everything but American Idol and our spokesperson. And is on the task force for Governor DeWine in Ohio and helped make the ground rules for what the rules are going to be in the state of Ohio. She was head of that task force for that particular division, which was capacity and spacing. And we also had some input to help change Kentucky's ruling a little bit to make it more reasonable and still safe. That helped open up some more seats for Kentucky restaurants.
Man, what a great ambassador that you guys have in Brittany, your daughter. What's your favorite restaurant in Cincinnati besides your own?
Well, Skyline's my go-to place.
What's your order?
I'm trying to watch my carbs, but I always would have a four-way or a five-way. I got a few cans of Skyline in my cabinet. In fact, I had Skyline last night for lunch out of a can. But, you know, in Cincinnati, there's a lot of good restaurants, different, you know, casual, there's some upscale. And my competitors, group called Thunderdome, and they own a lot of casual restaurants. I told the owner, the co-owner, I have now eaten at one of your restaurants four meals in a row at three of his different places and different concepts. So they're good restaurants, you know, and my competitors, a lot of them are my friends, you know, so, you know, they're good restaurants, whether it's Via Vide, the Italian restaurant in Cincinnati, or Montgomery Inn. And, you know, but we have a lot of our, especially with COVID, the one thing that came out of this whole thing, especially in Ohio, where there was like 30 some restaurateurs from around the state of Ohio, from big time guys to mom and pop guys that was on this task force that the governor, you know, DeWine said, we want your input, which I don't know of another governor who did that. And we were all in this together, you know, and my competitors like Cameron Mitchell, probably the most famous restaurateur in Ohio. He's got places from coast to coast. And I knew him. And we were both inducted to the Restaurant Hall of Fame a year ago, the first two inducted. And so I knew him a little bit. But the relationship now, we went from competitors to teammates. And even some of the competitors here in town that weren't too friendly towards us, we've united and we've got a relationship now because we stuck together and became teammates, you know, fighting a common enemy. And that enemy is this pandemic. And in some cases, the government trying to strap us and, you know, but, you know, they're in a tough position too. They've got to keep the place safe. And, you know, so I don't envy them, but we became really bonded with our competitors. And like I said, some of them we were already had good relationships with, but now we're just friends, you know, and we're competitors, but we're friendly competitors. We're teammates. That's what came out of this thing, at least something good.
Yeah, that's great stuff. What was your first car?
My first car was a yellow Galaxy Ford convertible. I forget what year it was. I was going off to high school. Because in high school, I got myself a Honda 50. And G. Pederick, my football coach, took me to the dealership to help me negotiate to get a little Honda. It had a plastic little thing in front of it to protect the wind from your windbreaker, plastic. And I drove that around. And then I got a Honda 90 later on when I got a little bit older, I think about my senior year. So my first car, I was a Ford Galaxy. And so I'm visiting my mother's apartment. And I hadn't seen my mother or lived with her since my sophomore year of high school. And we kind of made up. And I went and visited her at her apartment in New Jersey in the summer, I think it was. So I get this car. It was a used car, but it was beautiful. So I called Nationwide Insurance to insure this thing. So the guy comes over, signs me up. Now I'm insured. 15 minutes later, I go get the car out of the parking lot. It was a big apartment complex. And I'm going past, you know, my mother's apartment, which was right on the street there, right on the road there. And I said, oh, I forgot my wallet. So I run into her apartment to get my wallet. And I come back out and my car's driving down the street without me. It was a manual, but the shift was right there on the console, you know, between the seats there, you know?
Oh, so someone didn't take it. It's rolling.
It's rolling. So I guess it got into neutral. I don't know.
Yeah, it wasn't your fault.
So I'm now running down the street, chasing my car, okay? And it makes a right-hand turn. Gravity took it over a hill, and it's going to face another brick apartment building, and it's going to smash right into the side of that building. And I'm running after it, you know, my shoes are full. I am trying to catch this thing and to get into that door and put my foot on the brake before it. Then it turns, and it goes, and it smashes into the parking lot. It avoided the building, and then it turned down this hill, and there was a car parked in front of their apartment, and it smashed that car right into it. And I called my agent, because I still had his business card fresh in my hand. I said, I just had an accident. He said, you're kidding me, right? I just left you 15 minutes ago. I said, yeah. And I told him what happened. He said, not only is this the fastest claim I've ever had, it's the first time I've had a claim with a two-car accident and nobody in either car at the time of the accident. So that was my first car. And then I got in college, I got myself a brand new 69 Dodge Charger RT, a la Bullet with Steve McQueen, before the movie came out. And it was lime green with a big black racing stripe, a 440 Magnum engine, glass packs on it to make it sound like a freaking jet. And it was jacked up in the back. And that's how I drove into Cincinnati to get my first job with that green lime Dodge Charger. That was my first new car.
So you just said McQueen. I'm putting two and two together. I've never heard that name besides my little kids watching the movie Cars, and it's Lightning McQueen. And I'm putting two and two together now. There's so many.
The movie was Bullet, and it's the greatest car chase in the history of Hollywood. And he's got a Mustang, and he's the good guy, and the bad guys are in the Dodge Charger. And the chase is all through San Francisco with all the hills, downtown, all that. And it winds up that the other car they were chasing with the bad guys just hit and just blew up, and they died in the car, and the whole thing blew up to smithereens. And that was quite the car scene.
Yeah, now I'm figuring out. Now I just figured out where Lightning McQueen came from, and that makes a lot of sense to me now.
Well, there's another movie that was on. It was a comedy, Searching for Steve McQueen or something, recently. And the guy, it's kind of a funny movie, but that's like, you know, 30, 40 years after Steve McQueen, you know, and he's been gone a long time. He died young.
You mentioned your high school coach a few times with the last name Bednarik. Is that a relation to Chuck Bednarik, who the best defensive college football, you know, Chuck the Bednarik, award goes to every year?
Yeah, the award is named after him. And wow. Chuck Bednarik was his brother. Chuck Bednarik played center and middle linebacker, went both ways for the Eagles. Came out of the University of Pennsylvania.
That's unbelievable.
And he was the greatest player. He was the one that knocked Frank Gifford out in the championship game. And I got that picture with him standing over Frank saying, "This effing game is over." And that's what he said as Frank lay there. I had dinner with Kathy Lee Gifford a few months ago at my restaurant. And I told her that my hero and my father figure was Chuck Bednarik's brother. And of course she hated Chuck Bednarik. She almost got up and left and walked out of the restaurant when I told her that. Yeah, Chuck Bednarik was quite a, you know, and Jeep played at William & Mary and was going to be with the Colts, and he blew out his knee, and that ended his pro football. But he was a man's man, big forearms, so I wanted that big form, so I started curling. I went from never lifting weights to doing sets of curls with 155 like it was nothing, just to get forearms like Jeep Bednarik, my hero. It changed my whole life.
That's unbelievable. I ask you this, and I feel like you're going to have a better answer than most. Who's the most famous person in your phone?
Besides you?
Come on now.
I don't know. Kid Rock is in there.
Ooh.
Guy Fieri's got 3.4 million Twitter followers, and I think he follows 200 people, and Toby Keith, I don't know, you know, the Chris Collinsworth, Jim Nance, Boomer, so there's a lot of people in there. Mario Lopez, you know, there's a lot of people in there.
Yes.
But Kid Rock is pretty big.
Oh, yeah. Kid Rock's incredible.
Guy Fieri is huge. So.
Yeah, I got to connect with him down at the Super Bowl in Miami this year. Incredible guy. I've been a fan of his from afar. Got to meet him a couple times. But
who's
we
that?
Really got – Guy Fieri, we got to connect down there for the at the Wheels Up party. He was great.
We went. He invited me, and my daughter and I went to his induction into the Hollywood Walk of Fame a couple years ago in Beverly Hills. So we went to that, and then we went to his party afterwards. And Matthew McConaughey gave the speech for him, and over there on whatever street it was where the Walk of Fame is, and the guy knows everybody. And then we went to the party, and the guy's been a good, very good. In fact, when he's done his drive-ins, diners, and diners, drive-ins, and dives, 3-day, he did it in Cincinnati. He said, "Come on, I want you to be sitting here. You'd be one of my guests I interview." And so I did, and he always gives me a big plug. Then when he did Louisville, he said, "Come on, I want you to go to this Irish pub, and I'm going to interview you and see how you like the food." Then when he did Columbus, where he was born, before we were ever open, he had me do at a barbecue place. So he's had me on his show in every city that we have a restaurant.
That's awesome. What's your favorite movie?
Well, Son of a Woman with Al Pacino is one of my favorites. It's quite a story. It was the first and I think only Oscar Pacino got. He plays a blind retired army colonel that befriends a kid. It's quite a ride. But his speech at this school where the kid's going to be expelled is the most incredible speech I've ever heard. I've used it to help a kid in a similar type of school, a private school, with the headmaster of that school trying to save this kid life. And I met with the guy and I said, did you ever see Son of a Woman? He says, no. It was all great. Of all people, not is this headmaster who's going to screw over this kid really bad. And the committee and the board all voted him out and they expelled him and all that. So I used those lines, but I told him where they came from because it was a similar situation. And Ron Jaworski, remember Monday Night Football? He used the line, but didn't give credit. He made it sound like it was his original line. And he said, you know, you can have an arm ripped off and you can have a leg ripped off, but there's no prosthetic. There's for a amputated spirit. And this team has an amputated spirit. That's the line from Al Pacino in prosthetic for, there's no prosthetic for an amputated spirit. And he sort of said, from Son of a Woman, but he did. He made it sound like, that's a hell of a line, Ron. That's pretty good.
Right.
The movie was great. Of course, The Godfather 1 and 2, Godfather 3 is as necessary as a third marriage. You forget about it, But the first two were great. And, some comedies, Analyze This and Analyze That. And Chaz Palminteri, who's a gangster, I met him in Baltimore. We had dinner at his restaurant. Actually, he had a restaurant. And a couple of them, they were pretty good. Finally, the one went called Chaz in Baltimore went out of business. And I liked it. And Midnight Run is one of the most hilarious movies with De Niro and Charles Grodin. It's hilarious. I like comedies, especially I've been watching comedies all through this pandemic because I haven't been allowed out of the house. My daughter lives across the street. I think she got a GPS attached to the bottom of my, like a gangster, when you have a suspect and the FBI or the police put a thing under the car, a track where the car's going to follow the, that's what I think she's done to me. So I've just been watching a lot of comedies at home to try to cheer me up, So
that's a great way to do it. All right, last one. At what point is there an Eric Wood special on the Jeff Ruby's menu in Louisville?
Well, the only restaurant where we have items named for celebrities is the Precinct. It started in 81 and we've done that ever since. And we've gotten away from it there. And in fact, I'm not so sure there's even one left. But in the other restaurants, we never did that. The Precinct, it started with Steak Collinsworth.
Yep.
And that's become such a standard, I've got to have that everywhere. And it was really a Steak Oscar, but I named it after Chris. He was a regular, when his rookie year, he was a regular at the Precinct. And he's one of my best friends, and he's in my phone. But so we named that Steak Collinsworth. And now there's Steak Collinsworth in restaurants that I don't own, which really upsets me. And I'm in Las Vegas years ago. I'm waiting for a cab, and there's a guy saying, I was at your restaurant in Lexington. I had a Steak Collinsworth. I said, I don't have a restaurant in Lexington. And somebody else used that name. And that was 20 years before I had a Steak Collinsworth or had a restaurant in Lexington. But maybe there could be an Eric Wood fired something. Eric Wood fired salmon or Eric Wood fired, Chilean sea bass or something. Well, you know what we got in Louisville?
That's pretty creative off the top of your head.
We got a Chris Mac and Cheese. We have a Chris Mac and Cheese.
Yep. A neighbor of mine, another Cincinnati guy.
Yep. Yep. And yeah, he coached Xavier, and he's a good guy. And, you know, it's your buddy, Kyle Rudolph, you know?
Yep.
Your teammate at Elder, or your buddy at Elder. And first time I met him was in the locker room at Notre Dame, I guess his senior year. I'd never met him. Born and raised in Cincinnati, right? And he said, oh, yeah. I said, you ever been to one of my restaurants? Oh, just the one in Louisville. I said, the one in Louisville? I said, you've never been to the precinct? You've never been to Jeff Ruby's? You've never been to Carlo? No. And he's from Cincinnati.
Yeah,
and the only place he had ever been once was, and now he's been back quite a few times, was the one in Louisville. I don't know if he was with, well, he didn't know you. Well, yeah, he did.
I took him. Yeah, absolutely.
You took him? That's where it was.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Well, Jeff, I can't thank you enough for your time today. Your words will be so impactful for so many out there. It's incredible to dive deep into your story. What an incredible story you have. Thanks again, Jeff.
Well, you've been very kind to me, and your words are appreciated. Thank you, and stay safe, my friend.
Absolutely. You
too.
I
hope to see you soon in Louisville.
Absolutely. Let's do it. Thank you for listening to What's Next with Eric Wood. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please rate it 5 stars and subscribe. That goes a long way for us with this podcast. Tune in a couple weeks for another new episode.